and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Anchorage Creeks 101 with Dr. Thomas Ely from the Anchorage Waterways Council. Hosted by REI Anchorage, Dr. Ely was recorded on Tuesday, September 18th.
Well, my name is Tom Ely. I'm with the Anchorage Waterways Council. I am a research associate. That means I do whatever sort of stuff comes along. And I have up here Matt Kays, who he does all the good stuff, all the fun stuff. So if you want to hear about all the fun stuff, talk to Matt. And we'll be around to answer questions afterwards. But we're going to talk a little bit about creeks, and I'll ask Matt that if he has anything that he wants to add, that he's certainly welcome to chime in. He's about to take a swim in Ship Creek to retrieve a sensor here in the near future, and which can be fun. Okay, we're going to talk a little bit about our creeks in town, and some of you may know some of this, and I apologize if I say something that you learned in Geography 1 or whatever, but just to kind of give everybody an equal balance. Anchorage Waterways Council has been around since 1984. It's a group of concerned citizens that are interested in creeks and protecting them and enhancing them, and it's a nonprofit 501c3 sort of thing. But the mission is to protect, restore, enhance the waterways, wetlands, and associated uplands, which are related to the wetlands, which are related to the creeks, in the municipality here of Anchorage. And the municipality, of course, remember, extends all the way down to past Portage Valley and all the way up to Eklutna. There are millions of creeks out there, and we just aren't able to do all of them. There are some that we would like to learn more about. And I'd like to thank REI for putting this on. I think it's a good way to introduce the community. And I think that's one of the things that's in the past has been sort of problematic with the Waterways Council, is that they haven't been out in the public view as much as they should be. They're out there for creek cleanup, and everybody kind of knows about creek cleanup. And then after that, it's like, okay, so what else do they do? We have all sorts of sponsors: Fish and Wildlife Service, Bullitt Foundation, ConocoPhillips, Alaska Center for the Environment, and so forth, and a number of other contracts that come along from various different agencies that support our work. I'll talk a little bit about water, because water is what it's all about, and you all probably have heard about the water cycle. We don't have a whole bunch of water here on Earth, by the way. We have about 50% of the ocean waters in the Pacific, 26% in the Atlantic, 20% in the Indian, and 4% in the Arctic. 2.7% of all the water is fresh. And of the fresh water, about 77.78% is surface water. Then we have soil, moisture, groundwater, deep water. That's all the water that's underground that we pipe out with wells, or pump out with wells and whatnot. And of our surface water, 99.357%, how about that accuracy, is on glaciers and ice. I suspect there's less than that right now. But then we have freshwater lakes, saline, atmosphere, river, and streams. So when you look at the very end of the equation, if you will, there's not a whole bunch of water out there. Hydrologic cycle is basically where our water comes from, and it's rain, which starts with evaporation from the ocean and from the land. And then it falls back to Earth. We've all experienced a lot of that in the last few days. Forms clouds and then falls back to Earth as rain or snow. And then once it hits, then it advects in the atmosphere. And then we have either it flows over the surface or it flows underground back to the ocean. So that's where our water comes from, the hydrologic cycle. It goes on everywhere. The numbers vary. In the deserts, the evapotranspiration is high, the precipitation is low, and those sorts of things. So where do we get all our fresh water? Well, we get it from rivers and streams and lakes and wetlands and ponds, and then our subsurface flows and our aquifers, and we have some aquifers. I'll just mention that you may not know about, but in California, for example, in the Central Valley, the water that they're pumping out for agriculture there was deposited back, you know, 20 million years ago in the Pleistocene. So what they're doing basically is mining water and using it, and it's not being replenished. In the hydrologic cycle, we think of the water being replenished. Precipitation, evaporation, precipitation, evaporation, and that the water is being replenished over time. And in most places it is, but in some places it's not. It's prehistoric water, and one day it's going to run out. And then, of course, we have variations that have to do with geography and topography. We have areas of high precipitation, like down here in the Amazon. We have areas of low precipitation, like out here in the Sonoran and Chihuahuan Desert. And up in Fairbanks, Fairbanks gets about as much precipitation as Tucson, Arizona. It's basically a desert. It's just that it has, right now, it has permafrost, and the permafrost holds the little water that does fall. It holds it there and makes it available. Same thing up on the North Slope. So you start looking at these areas, and there are lots of variations. And now we throw the whole climate change, for those of us that want to admit that climate change is underway, and it is. We have variability over time. Some years we get what we expect to get, and some years we don't get what we expect. It can vary up to 40% or more in certain areas. So it can be unusually wet. My son was just in Australia, and there were floods. And I just wrote a friend of mine that lives up in Darwin, and now they're in droughts. And so, you know, those sorts of things go on. There's a lot of variability. And the variability is increasing with the climate change. It's increasing in different areas in different ways. People are seeing, well, for example, in the U.S., they said, oh, man, we had the warmest winter in all of history last year, you know, and we're up here freezing our back seats off with lots of snow, and it's the coldest coldest winter in Anchorage history. And then now they're having droughts, and we're having rain. We have rainy summers, you know. There is climate change. And then you go up to the North Slope, talk to the natives up there, and they'll tell you that things are different. The ice is different. We don't trust the ice anymore. We know what the ice does. We go out in the ice. We've hunted it for years. And now it's not acting right. And they're very uncomfortable with it. Well, the upshot of all of this, of course, is that in some places we get a lot of water, a nice amount of water. Some places we get excessive water. And we've had that in the last couple of days around here. Some places we get intermittent water, like here in Australia and Waluna. And some places we don't have any water. And the water crisis is one of the big environmental issues that's out there today. That there is not enough water in many places, like Los Angeles, which is built basically in a desert, you know, and on other places. I was in Palm Springs last year, and I'd never been into Palm Springs, but I tell you, I was just shocked. I mean, here you are in the middle of the desert. Man, there's a grass everywhere, golf courses. Stayed at a hotel that had 57, count them, 57 swimming pools. And not didn't count the fountains and all. So water is going to be a problem. And we're fortunate here, as when I lived in Northern California in Humboldt State, when I got my bachelor's degree there, we were in an area of California where there's lots of water. And the people in Southern California wanted us all to send it down to them. And we said, not in this lifetime. And it's still a fight that goes on about, you know, where do you get water? Well, we all live in watersheds, and in the 70s and in the 80s, there was a movement that some of you may recall called deep ecology, and deep ecology meant that we had to start to recognize, it was more complicated than this, but we needed to recognize that we were part of the ecosystem, that we were not above and beyond what all went on in the world. And we needed to look at the watershed that we lived in, or live in, because that's our whole supply of the basic resources and the basic things that affect our lives. And maintaining the quality of that watershed will, in fact, enhance our life. We have to look at that as sort of a management unit. And, of course, we have divides along here where the water goes over into some other watershed. This is a very simplistic watershed where you have groundwater coming out and surface water coming down. And if we live in this watershed, everything that goes on in there is important to us. You know, I mean, a lot of things that affect us, maybe upstream, and of course some things are out of our control, like we don't have all the food resources we'd like to have in Alaska, although the farmers are doing their best to try to grow them, but we need to maintain the quality of our watersheds. And this is sort of the geographer's view of it. Watersheds are way more complex. We might, if you view this maybe as Chester Creek or Campbell Creek, you've got all sorts of tributaries going out. You've got some highland in between. And on these interfluves, the water goes across the land and then goes down the gullies and the rills and whatnot into the creek. But then there is some divide around here, the watershed boundary, for which everything within that boundary flows in to, say, Campbell Creek or Chester Creek or Fish Creek, and then goes down into the ocean and out to sea. This is a big watershed drainage here. This is for the Missouri River, which includes the Missouri, the Platte, the North Platte, the Laramie, all the whole tons of rivers, the Red River, and so forth. And then, of course, the Continental Divide, where all the rivers on this side go to the Pacific, all of them on this side go to the Gulf of Mexico or to the Atlantic Ocean. So we live in a watershed. We all live in a watershed, and we have to be concerned about our watersheds. These are the watersheds of the municipality of Anchorage. Some of them are very familiar to people, Campbell Creek, Chester Creek, Ship Creek. Some of them you may have never heard of, Hood Creek, Fire Creek, the Kootenai River you probably have, but then there's Furrow, McHugh Creek, some of you have, I know. But then there are other ones that are really important, but we have a number of them. And some of these creeks, like Furrow Creek and Fish Creek, have just been so abused. I mean, they're gone almost, or they're just remnants of it. I don't know how many of you have been to the BP Science Center over there at BP. When you walk into the Science Center, there's a gully there. That gully is a part of Fish Creek. It used to flow over through where the BP building is. It flowed over to Fred Meyer's, and then it went across through Sears and whatnot. And that was channelized and put underground by the 1950s. And then it comes around in other areas, and it goes through Cuddy Park, where they've moved it, actually. It actually goes to the library parking lot, but they've moved it out to Cuddy Park. And it goes up through the Aleutian building there, the Aleut Corporation, and Brown Jug is there. And if you go to Brown Jug parking lot and look over the fence, there's kind of a little pond there. That's part of Fish Creek. And then Fish Creek went across, and then there was a lake, a big lake, right where the Fish and Wildlife Service is located. And that lake was where it used to be the highest density of nesting Canada geese. So that's why if you go to the Fish and Wildlife Service in the summer, there are all these Canada geese kind of standing around going, you know, where did it go? It was once here, you know. So there are lots of them. And Furrow Creek's another one that is just down in South Anchorage down there off John's Road and up into the hillside a little bit. It's just been totally abused and almost, you know, just a remnant of what its former self was. But Furrow Creek, Fish Creek, all these maintain at one time salmon populations, as well as trout, of course. And this is the late Neil Armstrong's footprint on the moon. And if there was water on the moon, I guess they say this would be a watershed because water would go into his footprint. He got buried at sea, by the way. I don't know if you all know that, but he got buried at sea, which I thought was kind of cool. Okay, we have the water going theoretically through our channel. In the center, in a perfect world, in the center, the water is the fastest. It slows down toward the sides because of friction. It slows down toward the bottom due to friction, the water against the bottom. And the water moves along carrying stuff with it. And we call that the stream load. It can be dissolved, clays and silts as suspended or dissolved. It can be the bed load, which is the rocks that move along. They either move by saltation, which means jumping, because it's pushed along and it bounces, or traction, that is the water is just going so fast, it's just pushing those along. So we have material going down, and we see that all the time, particularly during the big rain events in our creeks. We see the silt that's in there. Of course, anything else that goes in there goes along with the suspended load to wherever it goes. And of course, it causes erosion. Some of stream erosion is very natural. Those of you that are rafters and all know about stream erosion, where we have the stream starts to zigzag, it starts to meander. We have the thaw egg, which is the deepest part, which theoretically would be right down the center, but because of deposition and erosion over here, it starts to move away, and we get deposits and whatnot, and we get these curly rivers. Even parts of Chester Creek, where Matt and I were a few weeks ago working with the young people, it looks just like this. You have these shallow bars, and you have the deep water over here. And the deep water can be over your hip boots, or it can be over your head. This is sort of how a meandering stream, I think it's kind of cool. Over time, it just meanders, and then it tends to straighten itself out. Meanders widely, forms loops, oxbows, and then it has oxbow lakes, which are lakes that were cut off. They tend to straighten themselves. Over on Chester Creek, we were able to show kids an oxbow, and then where the stream is now cutting across and tending to straighten itself out on a smaller scale than you see, for example, on the Yukon River, where you might have an oxbow like this, and it's about a half a mile across, but it's about 2 miles around to get around there. So it's a really long trip. And we get all sorts of channel patterns. Braided channels are very common in Alaska, where you have flows that are massive and then they slow down. On my mantle, I've got a propeller that I had in a boat that I took from Fort Yukon, Central and Circle to Fort Yukon. And you start down some of these and you don't realize where they're going, and then all of a sudden your engine, your blades or your propeller are hitting the rock and you have to drag it back up, get it over here and figure out, which is the deeper channel here, you know? Am I going to be able to get through here, or should I go over here? And it's a lot of guesswork, and there's not much of this propeller that's left. When I quit working there, they gave me that as a going-away present to remember for... It was really a fun trip, but I had a man working for me by the name of Orville Huntington. His father was Jimmy Huntington, and his uncle was Sidney Huntington. And Orville was great, and he goes, "Tom, let's never go there again." He didn't like it. Okay, and then we have all sorts of erosion that goes on, where oftentimes above you have resistant strata, and then you have less resistant strata, and so you get erosion down here, you get kind of an overhang, and then things happen and it falls in. Over on Campbell Creek at the New Seward, where they're building the new bike trail, if you go about 300 yards down the bike trail, there is a nick point where an oxbow is formed. And in the 10 years that I've lived there, it's probably receded 20 feet. And it's now 20 feet from the new bicycle trail. So those are the sorts of things you have to be considered. Natural process. We're not involved in it in any sort of way, but it just goes on. Okay, talk a little bit about Anchorage. We're an MS4 city, which means multiple separate storm sewer systems. Basically, in a simplistic manner, what that means is that everything that comes down our stormwater drains, all our snow melt, all our yard water goes down the storm drain and goes into the creek. It does not go to the sewer. And people don't know this. They assume that it goes to the sewer out there by Port Wrenzhof. But it doesn't. It goes right into the creek. So anything that goes in your yard or goes into the street becomes part of the creek. And a lot of it is not very good. We have our stream load again. So not only do we have rocks and material being carried down, but everything else that goes in there. Could be other sediment, it could be chemicals, it could be oil, it could be gasoline, it could be from my neighbor's beat up old truck that he's been working on and then washes down his driveway and so forth. So we have a lot of threats to our watersheds and waterways here in Anchorage. Urbanization, we create impervious surfaces, places where the water can't sink back in, so it's carried along somewhere and then goes down a storm drain, carrying all this silt and debris with it. We have vegetation removal. Go over there where the new bike trail is being created there on Campbell Creek by the new Seward and look at vegetation removal where they've removed an area of trees, about 2 acres at least, to build the bike trail, which is good, but you could build a 2-lane road on this area that they've cleared. And it's going to be paved. It's not going to be paved before winter, but right now it's eroding, you know, because of the rain and whatnot into parts of the creek. But we have people that construct, and there are all sorts of regulations that they have to put out this silt fencing, and this is just like the sloppiest job of silt fencing you'll ever see. It's got to be buried, it's got to be tight, because it is illegal to put any sort of pollution into the waters of the United States. That's the Water Act. And you can be fined up to $35,000 a day for doing that. And a lot of the construction guys, like we were talking earlier, you know, they've done it this way for 1,000 years. We don't want to do it any different. We don't want the federal government telling us what to do. But it does cause problems for our creeks. Here's Little Campbell Creek, which some people think is a ditch. You know, and so they just push stuff into the creek. Then we have mining concerns, and this is the Pebble Mine, and that's sort of what we all think of as mining. And when I worked in New Guinea, I worked with the Oktedi Mine, which is very similar to the Pebble Mine, where they move massive amounts of earth. Actually, they carved off the tops of a mountain. They created little lakes, tailing pits, where they put all the bad stuff so it wouldn't contaminate the environment. Well, New Guinea is in the tropics, and you get lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of rain, and the tailing areas gave way, these lakes gave way and dumped the tailing pollutions that were in the tailing ponds into the Fly River, which then killed turtles, crocodiles, dugongs, which are like manatees, fish, people, invertebrates, and so forth. And that's what people are worried about up on the Pebble Mine, because we've got all these trout streams that are close by there. That, you know, that one of these things breaks, it's all over with. Here's one here: iron contamination at Blackbird Creek, Idaho. It's abandoned operation. The leach, the stuff that's left in the soil, in the rock, then pollutes the nearby bodies: copper, lead, and mercury. Anybody lived in Fairbanks? If you live in Fairbanks, like in Esther, I lived in a cabin there when I first went there, and you couldn't drink the water. I rented this cabin from this little Irishman that's about this tall, Paddy McFadden, and he said, "I've lived here all of my life, and I've drank the water. It's fine, but it has arsenic in it." And he had no teeth and no hair, and he was really kind of wizened. And I was like, "Don't think so, Paddy." So I'd wash dishes with it and whatnot, but I would not drink it. And then here's the creek. The yellow part is the creek that's left after the mining because of the high levels of copper. There's nothing left. It's just a little sort of yellow water. And then you can have, this is in Hungary, but where one of the tailing areas breach, the ponds breach, and dump the pollutants in to the creek systems and the river systems. Killing everything, of course, along the area. Now, we don't have, fortunately, those big things going on here, but we do have some mining. We do have the Crow Creek Mine, which is an operating mine. We have some other little miners along Crow Creek and other areas. But there's some potential there, and I've been really interested in Glacier Creek because of the Crow Creek Mine. And we've monitored it fairly heavily. And I have to say, the Crow Creek or the Glacier Creek water is pretty doggone good. You know, whatever's going on up there, I think it may be more recreational than anything, and I think it's not causing a big problem, but it certainly could. And then there, you don't know what's there from 1898 when they were mining up there, or 1897 when they first started mining up there. And then if you go up almost to Crow Creek Pass, there's some sort of operation going on there, and I don't know what the heck it is. It looks like a mining operation, but it looks like gravel mining, too. So I can't quite figure it out, and it's like, "Don't trespass here, we'll shoot you," and then talk about it, and those sorts of signs there. But something's going on there. And then we have gravel mining. And gravel is a big resource in Alaska. Because of the soils and the type of terrain we have, we need it. We need to put it out to build on. Most of our houses in Anchorage are built on gravel that were either put there by the glaciers or put there by a front-end loader. And this is one down in Texas where this big cat earth mover goes across the creek twice a day for 3 months to mine gravel. And gravel is in short supply. I mean, we have Anchorage Sand and Gravel and a couple of other places, but most of the gravel companies have moved out toward Wasilla and Palmer area, where there are more resources and sort of less restrictions. But gravel mining is a nasty operation. And then one we don't think about, I never thought about it for years, and then it just sort of dawned on me. But it's snow mining. We mine the snow in the wintertime, and then we put it somewhere to get it off the roads. And these are the snow dumps. And these snow dumps, because they have a lot of silt in it, they melt very slowly. They have all sorts of debris in it, as you can see here. Somebody's blue tarp. And in one snow dump, there was a tent. And it was like, whoa, I hope that wasn't some homeless guy that got scooped up. But they're supposed to clean these up. And the adherence and the enforcement of that is very weak, shall we say. And these were not too long ago. These are down in South Anchorage, right off of O'Malley and C Street. And it does. I mean, some of them last all summer. They don't melt out. improper logging practices, well, you know, if we look at like places like Pennsylvania and Montana and whatnot, where they have big clear-cut operations, we don't have very much here. But we do have sort of a construction mentality that we cut down all the trees and then we rebuild, or we build and then we replant trees. We plant May trees or we plant whatever that we don't necessarily want there. There's no effort to try to work with the trees that are in, that are already there, that are really nice trees. And, you know, yeah, granted, some of them are big old cottonwoods that are probably going to come down, but there's still some nice ones around that will stay up. In the neighborhood that I live in, they didn't cut down the trees when they built. It was built during the 60s, but now they do. And the Department of Transportation, they've got a big bush hog that just comes along and just chops it all up. I mean, they take a tree and it's gone. And they seem to enjoy that because they seem to cut down way more. And in almost any development in Anchorage, and we've talked to the municipality about this, and it's like, well, it's easier to build if we do that, you know. Yeah, but you say we want to try to build in a green manner. That's not a way to do it, you know. And you talk back and forth with them, and you know, it doesn't. Some people aren't listening. And up in places like Fairbanks and whatnot, they have that issue because cutting a birch up there is really important. Then we have agricultural runoff, like Yaqui Valley, where they have the home of the Green Revolution. And you could, first thing you say is, well, Tom, well, we have little gardens in our backyard, but all the agriculture, that's out in Palmer and Wasilla and maybe down in the Kenai, and it doesn't affect us here. Well, it really does. Oh, there's the Mississippi River. And if you look at all these farm areas, there are little rills that go from the farm fields. And I did a turtle survey back here, so I'm really familiar with this area. And so all the farm fields deposit into the river during floods and whatnot, sediment and fertilizers. And the fertilizers have actually gone down the Mississippi River, and at the mouth of the Mississippi River have created a dead zone because of the nitrogens and fertilizers and whatnot, and it causes algal blooms even at depths in the ocean. And all the oxygen is used up and everything dies. And so there are these giant dead zones. And they can take the type of chemicals in the water and they can go back and say 40% is the responsibility of corn, 30% is the responsibility of soybeans, 12% is the responsibility of potatoes or whatever. And it's really, really pretty interesting, but it's really causing some problems. But we have our yards, and we put all sorts of things out there to make our lovely gardens grow. Some of you may read Jeff in the paper, and who originally was sort of a put on the chemicals and get things growing, and now he's turned around and become very, very green in his gardening. He wrote a book about gardening with microbes, and Don't bag up your lawn and, you know, throw it in the Alaska waste, mulch it and put it back into the ground, and your yards will be better, and so forth. Fertilizers. And of course, that's my neighbor. If a little bit is good, a lot's got to be a lot better. And they put it on. And then weed killers. And of course, then you get the chemicals, the nutrients go into the water and can cause growth of algae and all sorts of aquatic plants, which are really cool. And we get these algal blooms, and the algae, of course, takes the oxygen out of the water. They're a metabolizing plant. They take the oxygen out of the water. And then we have the fish. I can't breathe. And then they die. And so we have fish kills. And we've had a little bit around here.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Dr. Thomas Ely from the Anchorage Waterways Council. He was recorded speaking on Anchorage Creeks 101 at REI Anchorage on Tuesday.
Then we have some other things that are of real interest, like ice melt, which I know REI does, I do. Everybody puts some out, you know, because they don't want customers falling on their lawyers. And it ends up into the storm system. There's big concerns about the airport and the de-icing chemicals they put on the airplane that in airplanes that end up in the creeks, and what happens to those. And that's a real sensitive issue. That's improper construction techniques. This is an area over near where I live, actually, that you probably won't believe this, but it actually got shut down. And they were polluting the water, but they contended that they didn't. In a lot of areas, when you start construction, you may end up with a lot of water. And you don't want that water in there. You want dry soil. So you dewater. So that's where all these hoses are and pumps. They pump the water out. And there's a formula and specifications on what you do with this water. You have to put it into something to filter it and whatnot. So we went over and talked to the guy. This guy cracked me up. He's, oh man, we're doing everything just by the book. We're legal. We're total. See, we're putting it all down this thing, and it's a filter, and it filters it all out, and it's cool. There's no problems whatsoever with this operation. He's one of those guys that wears gold necklaces, I think, you know. But anyway, this is what's coming out at the other end, coming into Campbell Creek, and then coming down. This was down by about just before you get to the freeway, to the new Seward. And so we called the people that dealt with those sorts of things, and he got fined. Actually, he went out of business, and the bank took it over, and now someone else has gone in there. And it's a very, right now, at least so far, it's a very neatly run operation. But, I mean, this guy, he was a sort of, you know, going to shine you off, and man, we got to, don't worry about us, man, we're fine. Yeah. There's an area over by Hanshoe where the silt fencing wasn't put in right, required by law, and so the sediment broke out, flooded the sidewalk, just like the Mississippi River. And then road gravel, pushing road gravel off, this caused the municipality or the Department of Transportation a lot of grief because it's putting fill into a waterway, which the Corps of Engineers regulates, and you have to have a permit. And the municipality didn't have a permit, or the DOT didn't have a permit. And actually, there was so much sediment here, gravel, that it formed a berm that you could walk across the ice. Even when the ice started to break up, it was hard enough to walk on. And they weren't very happy. This is the area that they're redoing now for the bicycle path. The bicycle path comes under here. Oh, there's going to be a path over here for moose, and the bicycle path on this side. The moose are going to go on that side, and the bicycles are going that side. Seriously, how are they going to know? Well, they will just know. I mean, sometimes you just get shocked with it. You go to some of these meetings and you think, like, am I in a different world or am I, you know, how are they going to know? And then there is a picture of an area in Wyoming where they have an elk crossing. And the elk religiously take it, you know. And so I don't know, maybe they will. I don't know. Moose, they're not a herd animal, you know. Elk may do that. Caribou may do that. And, of course, just pushing snow down into the creek, which is a no-no, big no-no. That's a big problem in this town. Well, it's just going to melt and become water and just go wash away. Well, yeah, it's got all that stuff. And then cleaning up in the spring when we got all this sort of stuff. And then, was it 2 years ago, they hadn't allocated enough money for it, and it's supposed to be done like 3 times a year. To scoop it up and clean it up so we don't have dust blowing around here and pretend like we're in Fairbanks, you know. And Well, we don't have any money to do it, but it's required by law, you know. It's... And then we had this blowout a couple of years ago, which no one knew what caused it. And if you notice right here, it's coming right out of this storm drain, right here. Doesn't start up here, and then comes down. And what happens is they go in and clean out the storm drains, and there'll be a lot of silt and rust and whatnot that's in there, and it blows it out. Well, one of our volunteers, Bob Mitchell, was there with a class of students, and they're looking at macroinvertebrates in the water. And then all of a sudden, he calls up, the water is red and we can't see the bottom. And then the municipality says, oh, yeah, there were some guys over there working there. They were supposed to put a filter in there, you know, and whatnot. So, and then this year, anybody here take this picture? Somebody who's supposed to be here took this picture. It happened again, as if by magic. Some people contended that it was an algal bloom. The municipality said, oh, we don't know anything about it. The mayor had to find out about it. It was round and round. And, well, that's the last we heard of it. No one's ever come up and... Well, we did have a contractor that was working there on one of the sewer mains or one of the storm drains. But, you know, we're not responsible for our contractors. You know, we don't know what they're doing. Excuse me? I think that's not what the law says. But, you know, those events, a lot of material down. Impacts in our neighborhood. We have dog poop. And that is one of the most controversial issues in probably in this town in some respects. It's Matt's favorite thing. He is Mr. Scoop the Poop. And... Actually, I'll just tell a quick story here, but a person in authority, not in the Waterways Council, suggested that Matt give lessons on how to scoop poop. It's like, give me a break. And we do have problems, and Matt can tell you more about this than I can, but for example, in a lot of these zero lot line housing units, people have dogs, and so I take my dog over here, you know, and he poops, and then I take him home, and then he's all mad, you know, well, that Tom never, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, well, you know, it's just part of nature, it's natural, and, you know, it decomposes and so forth. And so we've had a program where we've gone out to some of these that have been problematic and put little hangers on the door that says, by the way, you might want to clean up after your dog. And in a couple of places, we've put little doggy cleanup bags on there and hanging up on the door. And this means you, you know, sort of thing. So it's a real problem because there's bacteria and whatnot that are in there. Fecal coliform that get into the water, which is not good. Also, dogs are one of the big carriers of Giardia. Beavers get blamed for it, but dogs probably carry more than beavers. I did a study in about 1975 up in Fairbanks, and we found that sheep, mountain sheep, doll sheep, and caribou and moose carried more Giardia than did beavers. So, but it's out there. And if anybody ever had Giardia, ooh, it's a whole bunch of fun. It's you can't have more fun than having Giardia. It'll be your Christmas present for the year. And then we have people that are washing down with spray washers. And they wash the oil and the gas and all that sort of stuff. And it all goes down the storm drain. These are some of our nice neighbors here that have oil and yuck coming out. And then, of course, oil and you know, drippings out here, and then water comes out from the buildings and washes it all down. And of course, there's cigarette butts and all sorts of other cool things that are out there that cause problems. Spray washing your house. I mean, people have done it forever. You do it before you paint it. I did it to my house before I stained it again. And all the water just goes out and then down the street. But nowadays, instead of just using water, we've got all sorts of cool chemicals to put in it, you know, to get our car and boat washed, our fence, our deck, our multi-purpose, the crud cutter, you know, and so forth. And all whatever all these chemicals are, they go into the creeks. And then you could go out in the creek and wash your car. Now, this is the preferred way to do it. And that's because the car washes, well, they cost a whole bunch. Yes, they do cost a bunch. But they go down the sanitary sewers and into the sewer system and not into the creeks. And so you're not polluting the environment by doing that. It is more expensive. Or you could go up here to Wasilla. No, I mean, go up here to someplace and wash it just out in the lake there itself. And then we have people that water their sidewalks. I guess they're trying to get grass to grow on it. I'm not sure. But they always do it. Or they'll put the sprinkler out here in the middle and go, and it washes down the driveway, carrying everything with it. And then around the corner, and then down the storm drain. And of course, a lot of the storm drains get plugged up like this. Day before yesterday, I saw the municipality people out along Tudor, East Tudor, and they were sweeping all the mud off of the sidewalk into the street, onto the storm drain covers, so it'd be washed away. And then, of course, cigarette butts in places. And this year at our annual meeting, we're having a fellow that's going to come up and talk about cigarette butts. They are incredibly toxic to fish and to aquatic organisms. And then we have waste management, where you go by and you see these dumpsters that are leaking something, and you don't even want to know what it is. But it gets into the system. And then we have people with their storm drains. And they come down from the house, and then they come down the driveway, or come down like this. I mean, this guy could easily turn this 90 degrees and direct it out into his yard, you know, and it would be really fine. And one of the things that I did is I went over to the spa place and said, oh, okay, you guys put in these hot tubs. Are these connected to the sewer, or what? How do you empty these things? And they go, oh, you just empty them in your yard. I said, you don't tell people to go out and empty them in the street, do you? They go, oh, no, that wouldn't be good. We just tell them to empty it in the yard. And, okay. And then here's another way to do it. You just direct it out to the yard. Get it away from the foundation, which is what the builders and everybody want anyway. It helps your yard. It doesn't create a problem. And this is the Spinard Roadhouse. Kind of one of my favorite places to eat. And they seem to be pretty skookum about the things they're doing. But they've got their drains coming out into these grassy areas, these sort of rain gardens, if you will, where the water can be soaked into the ground and not directed out into the parking lot or whatever. Or you can build rain gardens, and there's a big project here in town about building rain gardens, which is where you focus all the... You dig a big hole, basically, and have all the water drain into that hole that you fill with all sorts of gravel and sand and whatnot, and it's sort of a depression, and then you can put all sorts of flowers and whatnot in there. And actually, the municipality will pay you and part of your expenses, I think up to $500 or something, if you want to put in a rain garden. But we still have stuff that comes down the creeks. And this is one of the things that we are finding in our creek surveys, and we'll talk about that in a minute, is that a lot of the culverts are getting plugged. Trash coming down the creek. Bags, garbage bags, Costco bag, or not Costco bags, but Costco uses boxes. But Fred Meyer's are Carr's bags. And then, of course, every year in May, we have our annual creek cleanup. Matt is Mr. Creek Cleanup, and we had great ones in the last few years, and we find all sorts of stuff. And actually, if you come out and participate in creek cleanup, you could win an award. We have all sorts of categories of cool trash that people find, like it could be used again. This came from far away to here, and so forth. But we found other things out there. We found guns, and we found weird things out there during the creek cleanup. But we encourage you to participate. It'll be announced. Okay, then we have invasive species. And, of course, we have pike. Pike are of great concern. They poisoned them out of lakes, but then they show back up again. And some people contend that they're naturally expanding their range. And I did a study of pike on the Yukon Refuge, and you would find these pike on these lakes that are way, way away from the river. And you say, how did pike get there? And you sort of visualize an osprey or an eagle carrying a male pike and dropping it, and then one carrying a female pike and then dropping it. And fortuitously they meet, and then you have all lots of pike in there. And then you look around the lakes, and it's like, man, that's a whole bunch of luck. You know, I think it's flood events, big flood events, are bringing them into some places like on the Yukon Flats. But around here, it's people are convinced that people bring them in. And now, of course, it's a big deal up in Nancy Lake, where you go up there and shoot pike with a bow and arrow. And granted, pike are fun to catch. And if you know how to clean them, they really taste well. But the fish down here just haven't adapted to them like they have up north. And places like the Yukon Flats along the Yukon River, we have pike, we have salmon, we have whitefish, and they've gotten along together for generations. But here, there's sort of a learning curve. And then we have all sorts of invasive plants that we're concerned about. A lot of you have been involved in that and removing them. And there are tons and tons of them out there, including some aquatics. This is a buttercup that actually is a terrestrial plant but can grow in the water. There's also an invasive, and they were thinking about how to deal with this, but it is a, what's our state flower?
Forget-me-nots.
What is it?
Forget-me-nots.
Forget-me-nots. Okay, good. You guys are good. There's an introduced forget-me-not. And to differentiate the native one from the introduced one is really complicated. I've had a number of botany courses, and it's really hard. But the problem is that these introduced ones are really stabilizing some of the banks along the creeks. So they do some good. And so, you know, we don't know if you want people out there ripping up banks or what, or how you're going to deal with those. But invasive plants are a serious, serious problem. If you haven't seen any, I mean, may trees are one, but bird vetch and others are just horrendous, and even some grasses. But of course, our wetlands and our creeks are habitat for fish and moose and ducks and beavers and mink, and corridors, of course, for movement of bears. Muskrats, a lot of muskrats, and more muskrats than I ever imagined in the city. Oftentimes they get, people think they're beavers, but they're not. They're about a third the size. And of course, for fish and coho salmon. And these are dead coho salmon that we often find after high turbidity events, like big rains like this, that they'll get so much sediment in their gills that they can't breathe and they die. So that's one reason we don't want a lot of sediment going in there. We want to try to keep it to a minimum. Now, a little bit about Anchorage Waterways Council. We have the Citizens Environmental Monitoring Program. Here's Matt at work. These are volunteers to monitor a specific site for different things like pH and dissolved oxygen and bacteria and so forth. They go out winter and summer two times a month, volunteers two times a month, over the course of the summer, 2 weekends, oh man. And then these are, we have 22 sites that are being currently monitored. We have 26 sites total. And we're trying to be more strategic. It used to be that anybody wanted to go monitor, like maybe this guy right here. It happens, this creek happens to be in his backyard. And so he wanted to monitor it, you know. And it's great. I mean, the guy is just like the most eager volunteer. He does it every month without fail, complete, total. He's a retired engineer. But it's probably not the creek that, you know, is necessarily the most important. But we've got a number of them out there, and we monitor them, and we do reports on them. And we have our education and outreach, which Matt has sort of become the head of, which is great because he really, really enjoys it. Creeks is classrooms, where we work with about a dozen schools. We go out there with the classes, parents, the staff, volunteers, and do all sorts of things like water quality monitoring, invasive species, macro invertebrates, other projects. It gets the kids outdoors doing things. And if you've never been out in the field with elementary kids or with middle school kids, you've missed one of the great experiences of your life. And they really like the macro invertebrates, which, of course, what our flies, our dry flies and our wet flies are designed to look like, because that's what the fish eat, what the water ouzels, the dippers eat, and other things. And they're sort of the meat and potatoes of the ecosystem along with the sticklebacks. And if you have a lot of macro invertebrates, you have a healthy stream system. We have outreach presentations such as this, door-to-door visits of businesses, and households putting little things on, say, clean up your poop, guy. We have brochures. We have our annual meeting, our annual creek cleanup. We have scoop of the poop events, which are really quite popular, actually. And botanical garden, the botanical garden show. We always have a booth up there and meet all sorts of interesting and strange and fun people. We have stewardship issues. This is one of my favorite parts. It's because citizens call up and go, there's a mattress in the creek. Who gets it out? Well, that mattress is going to be pretty heavy. Not going to be me. So you find volunteers to do it. We got the mattress, we got the Coast Guard. Fortunately, we had a whole bunch of Coast Guard guys, and they were able to get it out. And this one is a refrigerator. Now, they call the municipality says, oh, it's in the creek. It's on the bottom of the creek, so it belongs to the state. So fishing game was, we don't do refrigerators, you know. DNR, we don't do refrigerators either. The problem is it's got Freon in it, so it's a hazardous substance. So what do you do? Well, about the same time we got a call from the Air Force, one of the squadrons over there, the Bulldogs, flew the F-18s, or F-35, the Raptors. What are the Raptors are called?
F-22.
Yeah, the Raptors. 35 is what the Marines are getting. Anyway, they said, we want to come do some citizen help, you know, and you have something that we can do? And we said, you got any muscle over there? We got lots of muscle, strong in back, weak in mind, we can do it. We said, well, we got to get this refrigerator out of there. And they go, that's no problem, we can do that. So they show up with burying all sorts of cool instruments like four-wheelers and whatnot. And then these guys just carried it up the side of the hill and deposit it up there on municipality land. So then you give the municipality a call and say, oh, you have a refrigerator on your land. And they don't like to deal with it because they have to deal with the Freon, and they don't have any money in their budget for dealing with Freon from spurious refrigerators. And, you know, if we take a refrigerator or whatever over to the dump, we're going to pay for the Freon that's in it. It's going to cost us some money. So that's the sort of thing you have to do. But after you get these guys working hard, they have a whole bunch of fun. You have a nice growing creek. They bring their families along, and they have a good time, you know. And they feel like they've done something for the creeks, and which is a good feeling. Helping their, and that's really big with the military right now, is being an active partner with your local city. in various things. Why do we do all this stuff?
I don't know.
For the high bucks. Well, because we all live here in a watershed, and everything we do impacts that watershed and the waterways in the watershed. And we want to live in a good place. That's why we live up here. This is a cool place, and we want it to be nice. Okay.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Dr. Thomas Ely from the Anchorage Waterways Council. His talk, entitled Anchorage Creeks 101, was recorded at REI Anchorage on Tuesday, September 18th, 2012. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.